You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, splashy splurgers, splicing splendors, and splattering Splenda. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 233, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your bodacious bodies, buying body sprays and body boards from body-guarded bodegas.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris. All right, wait, before we do anything, okay, hold on, all right? Okay. Because we haven't done this on the show in a while. One of our favorite things to talk about are egg corns. Not just malapropisms, not just using the wrong word, but using the wrong word or phrase in a way that might actually be better than the real word or the real phrase. For example, egg corn, the word came from little old lady who called acorns egg corns because she, you know, they're kind of like, they look like an egg and a corn. They look like sort of a piece of kernel of corn or like an egg or whatever. So like, it makes like a weird kind of sense. Yeah. What are some of the ones that we've talked about? Prima donna, like not prima donna, but a pre Madonna. Like she's acting right. So high and mighty, like she feels like she should come before Madonna. You know what I mean? That sort of thing.
Oh, wow. That's funny.
A long-running magazine, actually, The New Scientist, just tweeted a couple of days ago about a foolproof solution. Proof.
It's foolproof. Yeah. It's not half proof.
It's a foolproof solution. But the one that I wanted to talk about was one that a listener brought up actually recently in the Good Job Brain Facebook group, which I thought was really good. Somebody talked about a show, a TV show or maybe a Netflix program that was so good. They sat down and bench watched the whole thing. I bench watched it. Like I sat on the bench and watched it. Didn't get up off the bench. Exactly. Just bench watched.
Wow. Myself to watch this.
So yes, we every now and again we like to do egg corn watch. So continue to submit your egg corns.
As the parent of a toddler, this is not exactly the same thing. Toddlerisms. She has her magnifying glass, but she calls it her finding glass. And I'm like, oh, sure. That makes sense. Yeah, you use it to find things. Yeah, why not?
Well, I had when my son was probably 3 years old, we were going to Disneyland. I'm like, he's like, oh, I need to put on sunscreen. And I'm like, sunscreen. And he's like, he goes, no, sunscreen. I'm like, no, it's sunscreen. And he goes, you know what? We're both right. I'm like, yeah. I said, you know, it screens out the rays of the sun. He goes, yeah. And it's a cream that stays on you. And I'm like,
yeah.
Okay. All right. Sunscreen it is.
My kid called his elbow his elbone. Which I think happens to people.
The elbone, because it, sure.
It makes so much sense.
Oh, makes an L.
It's an L, yeah. And it's a bone, yeah.
Wow, uh-huh. That's an acorn. Yeah. Some of the things people submit, not acorns.
Not acorns.
That's pure, just malapropism. That's just using the wrong word. This has to make a weird kind of sense.
Well, in updates land, I know we just had egg corn watch. I have lobster watch, lobster updates, lobster dates. It's going to sound so ridiculous. So I was talking to my mom on FaceTime. She was telling me about like, oh, and so is selling a house in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Hmm. And, you know, she's telling me this and I'm like, wait, why does that place sound so familiar? And then my mom, without any delay, followed up with, their red lobster is the best red lobster I've ever had in the country.
Wow.
And she goes, it's across from Lowe's. Like, as if I know where this red lobster is.
Yeah.
A couple episodes ago, I talked about someone finding the rare blue lobster at Red Lobster. It is at this one at Cuyahoga Falls that my mom is a very big fan of.
The one across from Lowe's.
It's right across from Lowe's.
They need a little plaque on the wall.
I know. And I told her the story. I was like, you know, they found a rare blue lobster at Red Lobster. And then just a couple days ago, Kellen Freeman on Twitter tweeted at Good Job Brain and said, we stopped by the Akron Zoo and saw the blue lobster. And a picture of the blue lobster in the tank from the Cuyahoga Falls.
It's red really blue.
Isn't that crazy?
It's stunning. It's a beautiful, beautiful animal.
Yeah. Her name is Claude. But yeah, so some updates on the blue lobster for some reason all kind of converged. Without further ado, it's time for our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz, Hotshot. Okay, right hand or left hand? I got two cards here.
Left hand.
Ooh.
Okay.
Okay.
Here we go. Blue wedge for geography. Which region of the United Kingdom is not part of Great Britain? Chris.
Which region of the United Kingdom is not part of Great Britain? Northern Ireland.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, all right, okay.
Pink wedge, which pesky creature became an internet favorite after it was filmed dragging a slice of pizza down subway stairs in New York?
Oh my gosh.
Dana.
Pizza rat. A rat.
Pizza rat.
Video shot by friend of the show, Pat Bear. Shout out to Pat Bear.
That was him?
That was him. He's the one on the video going, get it, rat, get it. That's Pat.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
There he is. Yeah.
Get it, rat. Oh my God. Right. Next question, Yellow Wedge. Who beat eBay Titan Meg Whitman in the 2010 California gubernatorial race, even though she dropped a record $140 million on her campaign? Once again, who beat eBay Titan Meg Whitman in the 2010 California gubernatorial race? Why it's so hard to say?
Sounds like weird.
Yeah, sounds like goo goo clusters. That's what I'm thinking of. Even though she dropped a record $140 million on her campaign.
So who won? Yeah.
Who beat Meg Whitman? Dana.
Was that Jerry Brown?
It is Jerry Brown. Correct. Jerry Brown. All right. Yeah. Purple Wedge. Who wrote, here's the book title, It Takes a Village and Other Lessons Children Teach Us? Colin.
I believe that was Hillary Clinton. Yes. Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yep. Hillary Clinton published in 2006 while she was first lady.
Mm.
Wait, she wasn't first lady then, was she? 2006?
Did it say 2006?
What does the card say?
Oh, did we find a
Trivial Pursuit error?
What is the? Yeah, can you read it again?
Okay, so it says who. The question was who wrote "It Takes a Village and Other Lessons Children Teach Us." The answer is Hillary Clinton, and then the note here says published in 2006 while she was first lady.
No, it was published in 1996 while she was first lady.
Laura Bush probably has something to say about that.
Yeah, 1996. Yeah, right? This is 10 years off. Oh, good catch, Dana. All right, Green Wedge for science. Which office staple was invented by Art Fry in 1974 because he was tired of his bookmarks slipping out of his hymnal at church? I'll read again. Which office staple was invented by Art Fry in 1974 because he was tired of his bookmarks slipping out of his hymnal at church? Chris.
The Post-it note.
Yes, Post-it notes.
Gotcha.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
3M launched the 3-inch square canary yellow sticky notes in 1980. Should I double check this year too? All right, last question, Orange Wedge. Which sport includes the player positions of gully, square leg, and mid wicket? That was a horse. Colin.
Cricket.
It is cricket. Mm. Gully, square leg, and mid wicket.
I was a little adrift until you got to the mid wicket. Exactly. Yep, for sure.
At first, I thought it was like a pirate sport.
Yes.
I was like, what piratey sport could there be? Yeah.
Cannonball. I don't know.
Hey.
All right. Good job, brains. Well, guys, I just won yet another radio call-in trivia contest the other day.
Yeah.
These poor radio operators. They're like, oh, it's her again. Yeah.
But I wait. I wait. I wait for the 30 days. And this time was pretty cool. It's for tickets to like the Art of the Brick, which is a Lego exhibition, like an art exhibit. And then the trivia part on the show was all questions about 80s toys. I was like, oh, okay, well,
what put was that the in question? My tally.
Oh, the question was, who is the greatest American hero? What toy comes with a birth certificate and adoption papers?
Okay. That's a good question, but yeah.
Just, yeah, classic. Okay. They're not you know, they're not entirely very hard, but I think when you're under, you know, under a time limit, it's like kind of like stressful.
Can I tell you, I commute an hour before you do, and the quiz show I listen to in the morning, I've never heard anyone win.
Really? Is it hard?
It's 10 questions in a minute. Is it hard? It's not that hard, but you do have to like move through the questions really quickly. But I want to hear you do it. I do it in the car with my kid when I'm driving him to school. So far, he's awarded me $4,000. Like, I can do it myself, but I also have to like get him to school. So
with that in mind, we're going to dedicate this week's topic to competitions, to contests, to rivalries. So this week, we're up for some friendly competition.
So I'm going to kick us off this week with a quiz I made about food competitions.
Yes.
All right, here we go.
It's our contests, reality shows, etc. Ooh. You'll see.
Here we go, guys.
Here we go.
Karen's so excited.
So get your barnyard buzzers ready.
All right. And
let's get cooking. First question. You get it? Okay, here we go. First question. It's said that the reason hamburger buns have sesame seeds on them is because of the 1954 winner of which American baking contest?
1954 winner.
American baking contest.
Yes, Karen.
Pillsbury.
Yes, the Pillsbury Bake Off. Yes.
Wow.
It's huge.
It's huge and very influential. So Dorothy Cuteen was the winner in 1954 with her open sesame pie. And before that, people didn't use sesame seeds that much for cooking. They used sesame oil, but not the seeds very much.
Oh.
And then I think just media was so limited. I was looking around. I was like, wow, everybody got really into sesame seeds because of this contest. But yes, they like were flying off the shelf and people started putting them on crackers and breads and pastries.
Oh.
There's different people have put sesame seeds on buns. Don't get me wrong. But that was like when sesame seeds became the hot new thing, the fad, which becomes Pillsbury. All right, next question. Which extremely soothing baking competition show might contain moments where they discuss soggy bottoms and the coveted Paul Hollywood handshake? Sounds like everybody. Chris. I'll say Chris.
I invite everyone to say it with me. The Great British Bake Off.
They have different names, though.
What's the U.S. name for it?
Great British Baking Show.
That's right. And you know why? Because Pillsbury owns the copyright to Bake Off.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh,
really? That's really good. You got to pay the doughboy.
Yeah.
Next question. Which state claims to not just be the home of chili, but also the home of the very first chili cook-off?
What?
Chris.
Like, I'm gonna say Texas?
Yeah.
Texas.
Okay, all right, sure.
So the first chili cook-off was 1967 in Terlinga, Texas. And San Antonio, Texas claims to be the birthplace of chili. Chili con carne existed before this.
Yes,
but it's hard to get the receipts, the paper trail.
The receipts. You're like, CVS receipt.
You guys are really insistent. So I'll say, okay, yes, Texas.
Always throw in the claims too there. You're fine. That's all. Yeah, you don't need to worry about it.
All right, next question. The Iron Chef, a show in which guest chefs challenge one of the show's Iron Chefs to a cook-off, is originally from which country? Karen.
Japan.
On the show, the Iron Chefs had specialties on the Japanese. Oh, do you know what specialties they had?
There's Chef Kenichi, who is the Chinese cuisine. He's the prince of Seichuan cooking, I believe. There's always a Japanese chef. They change. Sometimes it's Morimoto. And then there is the French chef, which is Hiroyuki Sakai. And then sometimes they have like a special guest Italian chef.
Yes.
Masa, or his last name is Kobe, I think. Yeah.
Okay. So Karen has a PhD in Iron Chef.
So I grew up watching the Japanese version. And then when I came to the States, that was like when the popularity was like about, you know, was really kind of gaining steam. And they have the dub version, the English dub version, which I enjoy. That is my preferred format. The English dub is so dramatic and it's so funny. It's like as if they're like dubbing an anime.
Yeah, those are the ones that I fell in love with.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
And I did the math, and the Iron Chefs from the Japanese version had a win rate of like 76%. So it's like you could win. You probably were not going to win, but you could.
That's respectable. Respectable.
Okay. From season 2 onward, Padma Lakshmi has been the host of which popular cooking competition show? Karen.
Top Chef.
Top Chef. And it's going to start its 19th season soon.
A current season right now. Is that the 19th season?
Oh, did it start? Yes. Yeah, I think it said March. It just started. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's a Oakland person.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. I root for them. I hope they win. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. The next question is, which Next Food Network star winner is associated with Hunt and Ride Wine, Donkey Sauce, and Flavortown?
Oh.
I think I heard Karen.
I think we all know it is the irreplaceable Guy Fieri.
Guy Fieri.
And I watched that show. The show, like, basically, it was like Star Search for the next Food Network star. I was really obsessed with Food Network for a while there. And it was very clear since episode one, you're like, this guy is going to win.
Mm.
Like he's just very charismatic and like knows how to kind of multitask. And you can just see. And I'm sure the execs were like, yeah.
He had a quote and it was something like, you know, some people are just born to cook and talk. And it was like, oh yeah, that's his deal. He just cooks and
talks. It's really hard.
Yeah.
We should go up north. I mean, I think he's from Santa Rosa.
Yeah, he has a winery in Healdsburg. Yeah.
Donkey wine?
No, it's Hunt and Ride. His son's Hunter and Rider. Yeah.
They're like, Guy, we might want to ease back a little bit on the donkey branding, on just everything. You know, it's a couple things here and there, but
it's an aesthetic.
Yeah. I almost was going to ask you who has more competitive cooking shows, Gordon Ramsay or Guy Fieri, but the problem is I couldn't tell. They have so many shows between the two of them.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it was like one would pull ahead and then the other one I'd find like a real obscure thing that they did, and I was like, oh, this is gonna be I'm actually minefield. So instead I want to ask you, can you name three Gordon Ramsay's competitive cooking shows, like where he's actually judging people?
I know Chris is a
Ramsay fan.
Master Chef, Hell's Kitchen,
US, but not UK.
Oh,
sorry, Master Chef US, Master Chef Junior US, Hell's Kitchen, and Next Level Chef, which we just finished watching. I'm sure there's more, but I just gave you four. I forget the name of it, but it's like Gordon Ramsay and two other chefs go on vacation around Europe and they like drive in a van together and stuff like that. Hilarious. Really good.
Travel log. I also found the F word. The F word is food, but he does curse and they don't bleep it on some of the later seasons.
Right.
So,
Yeah.
In that one, people are competing to add a dish to his restaurant. So you said Hell's Kitchen US, MasterChef US, MasterChef Junior US, Ramsay's Best Restaurant, Gordon Ramsay's Future Food Stars, MasterChef Celebrity Family Showdown, and Next Level Chef. And I really think they're more than this, but I was like, okay, I give up.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, last question. Every 2 years since 1987, the World Cooking Contest, or the Bocuse d'Or, has been held in Lyon, France. Chefs from around the world are selected to compete in a very elaborate and prestigious contest. They kind of call it the Olympics of gastronomy. There's a lot of honor on the line and like a bit of money. I think they invest more money than they win. But anyway, it's a big deal. Which country has won the gold most times? It's happened 18 times so far.
Oh.
Which country wins? I heard a dog bark first. Karen?
I'm going to guess, I'll just get the spicy guess out of the way, which is Japan.
No.
Ooh.
All right, well, let's make it official here.
Okay, Colin.
Is it France?
It is France. They won 18 times of the last 18 competitions. And people are salty about that. There is like, oh, is this the home field advantage happening? Can you guess how many times the U.S. has won? Just take a guess.
One.
Yes, yeah. Zero. One time. It was in 2017.
Are we sending Guy Fieri? Because
are we sending our best?
Are we really? You know, is this a dream team here? Or, you know?
One time, Spain spent like €1 million on their stuff, and I think you win just like €20,000 max. It is like the cost benefit. I don't know. They didn't win. They spent $1 million. They didn't win.
Didn't Taiwan just win some big competition?
Baking.
Okay.
Good job, you guys.
So recently on the show, now we talked about the Guinness Book of World Records, and it was sort of in passing. We talked about how there's like some awards that they don't give out anymore, mm-hmm. like they don't mm-hmm. run these awards anymore. And we put it in the category of fattest cat awards, like just awards where like that encourage people to engage in bad behavior or worse, like foist that bad behavior on an innocent animal, you know? So it's just stuff that we don't want to encourage people to do anymore. Here's one that I found in the Guinness Book of World Records 1970. I'm just going to jump to the most egregious one. I swear to God, this is the name of the Guinness World Record that appears in many books as recently as
officially.
The late 70s. Here, officially. This is the official, I'm going to tell you. Most alcoholic person.
What?
Says most alcoholic person, and it says it is recorded that a hard drinker named Van Horn, 1750 to 1811, born in London, England, averaged more than 4 bottles of ruby port per day for 23 years prior to his death at 61. He is believed to have emptied 35,688 bottles. You win, most alcoholic person. Congratulations. The worst reported case of compulsive swallowing described a woman with 2,533 objects in her stomach, including 947 bent pins.
Oh no.
My God.
One of the worst was the Guinness World Record for youngest person ever to walk on white hot coals of 400 Fahrenheit.
Oh no.
Like
how old were they? Just for
11 years old, and he was curiosity. Like he was a performer at a hotel, like a firewalk thing at a hotel in Fiji. But it's just like the Guinness Book of World Records at this point clearly felt like they were just simply observers of things that were happening, and they weren't influencing people, you know, to go do it. But it's like eventually, I think they realized, like, oh wait. If we make this an award, somebody is going to say, 11 years old, I have a 10-year-old right here and a bunch of charcoal briquettes. Yeah. Let's go. Bust this award down, right? Get him in the book.
Because the book is Guinness, so it was like for drinking, right? Like little drinking bets.
Yeah, I believe that the original history was like, in part to help settle, you know, bar wagers, and it was a nice thing for them to sponsor, you know,
Now there is like an extensive list on the site of these are things that we do not do. And so anything, I mean, first of all, anything that involves people, I think, younger than 16 years old, they simply do not even do any of it anymore because it's just like, because of the potential danger to children, things that could harm yourself, things that could harm the environment, da-da-da-da-da. And so there's a lot of stuff now, you know, before you attempt any Guinness World Records, you should look to see, because there's a lengthy list of things that they no longer even tackle.
Put down those 4 bottles of port.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 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 I was also kind of like, okay, well, this is kind of getting weird. Let me also look here at a few examples of Guinness World Record attempts that went really bad in a really funny way. So that's kind of where
I
landed.
In a funny way.
I want to bring things up a little bit before I take them way back down again. So in In 2008, at the International Food and Health Festival in Iran, chefs all got together to attempt to break the record of the world's longest sandwich. Okay?
Okay.
They put together, reportedly, a 1,500-meter long ostrich meat sandwich. Okay? That's almost 5,000 feet. At that would be $25,000 worth of $5 footlongs at Subway. They had invited thousands of people to come eat the sandwich when they were to watch and then like also eat a piece of sandwich when they were done. And international news was there, you know, to document the attempt and everything like that. The government was there because the Guinness observers don't go to everything, but like they will take like if a government authority or something like that like measures it and shows them like, okay, well, this is how we did the measurements, and, you know, then they'll accept that, you know, if it's all very well documented. It's hard to say exactly what happened or who gave the go-ahead or where the miscommunication was, but either way, everybody agrees that all the thousands of people there just started eating the sandwich before they could measure
it. Oh, no!
So they ate the record sandwich.
With no record.
Well, I mean, they didn't get the record, I don't think, because they ate the sandwich. So that was bad. Another good thing that happened once was an attempt at the longest free fall. The longest, like, you know, you do a skydive and you free fall for the longest period of time. Remember the Red Bull thing from 2012? The guy Felix Baumgartner?
Yeah.
It was everybody watches on the internet.
Yeah.
He literally, like, was up in like space. I mean, by the time you get as high as he was in the stratosphere. He was in space and he jumped out of the thing and fall back to Earth and then pulled his parachute and landed on his feet. Right. That was 128,000 foot jump, set the free fall record, right? Red Bull logos all over himself. But what I want to talk about is a guy named Michel Fournier, who at 64 years old was going to set the free fall record in 2008 or attempt to. This is in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. News media is there. Cameras are there. He's like, I'm going to jump from a height of 130,000 feet. I'm going to break the free fall record. Okay. He doesn't die. He does not die in the story. Do not worry.
Okay. It's a lot I can relax now. Good. I'm glad you said that.
We're also tense.
The way he was going to get the height was he was going to take the helium balloon, which was attached to a gondola. He was going to ride in the gondola up in the helium balloon. He had spent millions of dollars, by the way, personally financing this and other attempts that either didn't pan out for whatever reasons. Massive helium balloon was going to raise the gondola up. He gets the height. He jumps out. He does the jump. So they get there. They start inflating the big helium balloon. Balloon begins to inflate. Good, good, good. Balloon begins to go up into the sky. Excellent. Fine. Balloon continues to go up in the sky and continues on up and up. And up it goes because it's it's not actually attached to the gondola for some reason anymore. And balloon flies away. Oh, no. And they all just sort of watch it, like, there it goes. And now, importantly, I want to say this balloon cost $400,000.
Oh my God.
This was not even one of this is not a Party City balloon. This is like, yeah. So yeah. He did not make another attempt. There was no backup balloon. They just inflated it and just like, well, bye.
This was a cheap mistake because he could have lost his life doing this.
That's true. That's very true. Sloppy, that's true. So. Yeah, had it separated accidentally before. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. It's such a mom observation, Dana. Yeah,
I know. I'm becoming such a mom. Just really, anyway,
we can always replace the balloon.
That's right. People are precious. Right. Yeah,
that's right. Speaking of balloons, I think the worst Guinness record fail of all time. It has the pleasant name, and I'm so excited to introduce you all to, and there's going to be some people out there like, oh, I know about this. Has the name of Balloon Fest 86.
Okay.
Balloon Fest
sounds great.
86. Fun.
Yeah.
Now, before we get to Balloon Fest 86, to truly understand Balloon Fest 86, the mentality behind Balloon Fest 86, we have to just jump back a little bit less than a year to Skyfest 85. Skyfest 1985.
Okay. 85. Okay. These are great t-shirts, by the way.
Oh, they are. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you have the t-shirts.
Yeah.
1985 was the 30th anniversary of Disneyland. the Disneyland park in Anaheim. And the city of Anaheim, California, were like, we're going to do something amazing for Disneyland. We are going to have we're going to set the Guinness World Record for the biggest simultaneous balloon launch. The biggest launch of helium balloons into the air at the same time.
Oh, that's not good.
It was the mid 80s. You could just do whatever.
They didn't know. Yeah.
It was, well, I'll get to a little bit of the environmental stuff. But the previous record had been set in Japan in 1984, was 384,000 balloons. So on December 5th, 1985, what they did at Skyfest 85, right up in front of Disneyland, they put into the air simultaneously 1,209,000 balloons. And all the balloons had been sorted by color into these big transparent plastic tubes. And so when they launched them, what essentially happened at the same time is this sort of like massive rainbow of balloons. Oh, you know, like all the colors are separated out in the bands. I mean, they obviously start blending together, but they're separated enough so that it's this very colorful, vibrant rainbow balloons takes to the sky and floated, and they float away. Now, people had asked the question, like, where do they go?
Where do they go?
Well, latex, technically latex is biodegradable. So it does, right. It does actually degrade and break down eventually. It's not plastic. And basically, they were pretty sure that what was going to happen is the wind was going to carry them into the Nevada desert, where they would land eventually and biodegrade. And that seems to be what happened. Like there were nothing with the Disney balloons. It's like they went everywhere, but like they spread out so much and they, within weeks, they would be essentially gone. So we now come to Balloon Fest 86. Here we are. September 1986. It's the city of Cleveland, Ohio. And the city of Cleveland, Ohio was like, you know what? To heck with Walt Disney. Well, the city of Cleveland was like kind of on the rise, like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was kind of getting going. They wanted something to really boost the morale of the citizens of Cleveland. Cleveland's nickname had been for a long time the Mistake on the Lake. Not an official nickname, but people called it the Mistake on the Lake. It was just sort of like depressed little city on Lake Erie, and it was just like. They were just like, let's get out of that funk. Let's get that reputation. Let's break the Guinness World Record. Let's do what Disney didn't. Let's launch 1.5 million balloons into the air, shattering the record. The United Way, the charity, the United Way, they put this on. It was a big fundraiser for the United Way. All right. So we've all been to Anaheim, California to go to Disneyland. And we generally know that on any given day in Anaheim, like you pretty much count on like the weather, it's going to be pretty nice. And if it's not great one day, it'll be fine the next day. So when they launched the balloons in Anaheim, you know, they launched these balloons into the beautiful clear sky and they floated away by. Now, Cleveland, Ohio in September, the weather is maybe a little bit less predictable. No, and there had, in fact, prior to the morning of September 27, there had actually been a little bit of a storm the night before, which had caused some of the balloons to get loose prematurely. And the rain had abated, but they knew it was going to start raining later in the afternoon. They planned to release the balloons a little bit later in the afternoon, but they knew it was going to be raining. So instead of, like, you know, pushing it back or whatever, they pushed the launch earlier in the day. And at 1:50 p.m., a couple hours before they were going to do it, they let go about 1.4 million balloons, which were in these big nets in the middle of downtown Cleveland. So balloons get loose from the net. They all go up into the air. These balloons have not been separated into colors. They're all just in one big clump. If you're right in the middle of it, you see the colorful balloons. But if you're far away or look at pictures of this, it just looks brown, like because all the colors just blend together, and they all just come up out of one net. So and they're sort of puffing up, and it just looks like a big brown mushroom cloud, basically. Like it looks like impending danger. You know what I mean? And it's all against an overcast gray sky. It does not look impressive. the TV, there's TV footage of this happening. And one of the TV announcers, because the whole thing is super rah-rah, it's just the TV announcer actually says, "There is no mistake on the lake anymore. Cleveland has broken the Guinness Book of World Records. 1.5 million. And they're all going up. And it's like, okay, fine. And everything is great in Cleveland, Ohio for like a minute. Because typically what happens is you let a balloon go and it flies very high up into the air. But the storm, the cool air and the storm and the pressure system, you know, everything that's kind of happening takes all the balloons and just plops them right back down onto Cleveland and onto Lake Erie. They just come down. So like balloons, 1.5 million balloons come down in the city. They don't rise up. They come down and they come down into Lake Erie. The balloons cause car crashes because there's cars driving around in the city and suddenly balloons are everywhere.
They're
crashing into each other. An airport had to shut down a runway because it was covered in balloons. Balloons landed in somebody's horse pasture on their farm, and they had expensive Arabian horses, like the real expensive kind of horses, and they spook all the horses and the horses get injured because the horses are freaking out because balloons are coming down on them. And the worst part of this whole thing, this is actually where it does not get funny, but I cannot mention it without telling this story, and so it's sad. There had been a storm the night before, as I said. Well, just prior to that storm, there were fishermen. There were two fishermen who took their boat out on Lake Erie. And I think during the storm, they had disappeared. And at this point, there was a Coast Guard effort to find these guys somewhere in the lake. First of all, they're flying helicopters and the balloons are kind of hovering. So the helicopters are like, one of the pilots was like, it was like trying to fly through an asteroid field because the balloons are everywhere, coming from everywhere. And what are they doing? They're looking down at Lake Erie to see if they can see something that looks like a person's head. Because if they're in a life jacket, they would be floating on the surface of the water with their head above water to see if there's any survivors. But there's balloon. If you watch video footage, the lake is just covered in balloons. So, but they all look like a person's head floating on the surface of the water from where they are in the helicopters. They can't find, if the guys were down there, they couldn't find them. They were not able to rescue them. And like there were lawsuits, and all the lawsuits were against the charity United Way that had done this and put this on made the decision to launch the balloons anyway and didn't take weather into account. And so they end up actually losing money on the whole thing because all the money that they had brought in, the charitable donations and stuff like that, all went out paying like the wife of one of the guys who wasn't able to be rescued on Lake Erie lady and the horses and all that kind of stuff. It was a big disaster, but they got the Guinness World Record for the biggest balloon launch ever. But today, if you go to the Guinness World Records website and you look at the lengthy list of stuff they don't do, there is a line that is like, "We do not accept environmentally impactful records such as the largest release of party balloons." Yep.
Oh man,
so that record is gonna stand. Yeah.
Yeah, it's littering, if nothing else. Like, no.
It is.
Yeah. There's a bunch of garbage everywhere.
There was a thing for the Anaheim one, and it was just like, one of the news reports ended the final line of the report, which was, of course, was very much, and it was incredible, and, you know, just leaving us with the question, who's going to clean that all up? And it's like, that is a really good question.
Yeah,
that sounds like something that a journalist should go ask somebody. If only there was one around.
All right, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hi, I'm not LeVar Burton. You're listening to Good Job Brain, but you don't have to take my word for it.
And we're back. You're listening to Good Job Brain, and this week we're talking about competitions and contests, and I got a quiz segment for you guys about rivalries, about corporate rivalries, about number ones, number twos, maybe some companies going, attacking each other a little bit. So this will be a write down quiz.
Okay.
Question number one. From 2006 to 2009, Apple had a series of commercials starring personified versions of Mac and PC. What actor played Mac and what actor played PC? Mm-hmm. From 2006 to 2009, Apple had a series of commercials starring personified versions of Mac and PC. What actor played Mac and what actor played PC? We all good?
Yes.
All right. Answers up. Colin put John Hodgman, PC, Justin Long, Mac. Correct. Dana, Justin Long, John Hodgman. Correct. Chris is correct. Justin Long and John Hodgman. I thought John Hodgman was going to be the hard one, but I guess he really, you know,
he's Mr. Podcast.
Yeah, he's a podcast personality now. All right. Next question. Please complete the sentence. This is a tagline, an advertising tagline. Genesis does what blank? Genesis does what blank? It is a, what do you call it? A contraction? So it is one word, but there's like an apostrophe.
A portmanteau.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Genesis does what? Here we go. Nintendo don't. And Chris, Nintendo don't. Genesis does what Nintendo don't. Obviously, Sega is trying to push the Genesis and trying to tout its features.
In Japan, like, they don't really, they don't do attack ads. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. They don't do that sort of thing. And so, yeah, for them to do it in America and get the approval of Japan to do it was kind of a thing.
All right. Next question. Based on the number of locations, the top five coffee shop chains have Starbucks and Dunkin' as number one and number two. The other three spots are coffee chains not based in the U.S. If you can, please name all three of them.
Okay.
But 1 point for each. Based on the number of locations, and we're not including McDonald's or McCafe. We're talking about just coffee shop specialty chains. The top five has Starbucks and Dunkin' as number one and two. The other three spots are coffee chains not based in the U.S. Please name them.
I speak for us that we can all probably name one from our neighbor here, perhaps. But beyond that, it gets a little tricky for me.
It does get hard. I'll tell you. So one of them is Korean and one of them is UK.
Okay.
Top five coffee shops in the world based on number of locations. We have Starbucks number one, Dunkin' number two. The other three spots are coffee chains not based in the U.S. All right. Answers up, please. Oh, my God. This is very exciting. Colin, you put Tim Hortons. Ding, 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 ding. Tim Hortons from Canada. Dana's got the U.K. one. Is Costa Coffee.
Oh.
And Tim Hortons and Dana guessed Caffey House. Incorrect. Chris, what are your answers?
I put Tim Hortons. I guess I'm like, what do I know about Korea? I guess Paris Baguette, because like I know they're from Korea. And I'm like, well, I gotta put down something. And then I put Coffee King, you know, for the UK, because they're a monarchy.
Yeah.
Congratulations. It is Paris Baguette. Paris Baguette.
Oh, really? Really?
Is
Wow.
based on the number of global locations. Oh, they are a coffee shop chain, Paris Baguette. Yep.
Based oh my god.
I saw one in Vegas when we were there.
Yeah. They're everywhere here.
Yeah, I've seen them here. I had no idea.
There's a trivia lesson here, which is that and sometimes we have done this where it's like, oh, well, I know Paris Baguette is Korean, but that's not a coffee house, so I'm not going to put it down. You know what I mean? It's like, put it down. Put it down.
Don't censor yourself. Wow. Well, I cannot hang with this crew here. Nice. Costa. Well, that was
very international. Another food question. What fast food company debuted a sandwich and touted that it opened on Sundays, unlike its competitor? What fast food company debuted a sandwich and touted that it opened on Sundays, unlike its competitor? So I want the name of the place that is open on Sunday, not the one that is closed on Sunday.
Okay.
Answers up. Okay. Popeyes. Correct. Clean sweep. Yeah. It is Popeyes. Their chicken sandwich, just I think within the past couple of years.
I associate it with the start of COVID.
Yes, people lining up to get the chicken sandwich because famously Chick-fil-A, due to religious reasons, is closed on Sundays. And so Popeyes kind of capitalized on that and was like, we're open on Sundays. Also, we have also a chicken sandwich.
Come give us your money.
All right, here we go. Next question. The major film Ford versus Ferrari was, you know, about the real rivalry between Ford and Ferrari. And all set to the prestigious race of Le Mans. I'm not really sure how to pronounce that. Le Mans. It's the Le Mans race in the 1960s. So Ford did win. And actually Ford won another four times with what kind of car? The major film Ford versus Ferrari was based on true events about the Le Mans Ford and Ferrari rivalry in the 1960s. Ford did win and won another four times with what kind of car?
Sorry, you're looking for the model of a, like the name brand model of
I need the model. We don't need to know the make because the make is Ford.
Okay.
Right, but you want a model. Okay, okay.
Model T.
Yeah, right, okay, sure, yeah.
The Ford what is the car?
Oh, man, I'm torn between two answers.
The American company coming in to the European motorsport and then winning. Answers.
I'm gonna say the Mustang, just because it's so closely associated with Ford and the Shelby.
I couldn't think of any models of Ford car. I put Focus. I'm pretty sure the Ford. I don't know.
And then Dana put Corvette. The answer is the GT40, the Ford GT40. Designed by Shelby.
Yeah, I didn't think it was the Mustang because that just seemed like it'd be too easy. But yeah, like Chris, I kind of my mind just went blank there. what's another Ford?
Okay. Oh, Chevrolet-ed Corvette. No, but I was just like, I knew an American company randomly did Corvette.
I'm not a gearhead, obviously, but I'm really impressed by gearhead. Like, they are trivia people in their own world.
For sure.
My husband, he would see a close-up of like a little part of the car. He goes, oh, that's the blah, 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 blah. But they changed it in this year. And it's like, what? Yeah. You're crazy. Our favorite game is like, you know, comedians and cars with coffee. They do the little montage. And like, I try to time him, like, how quickly can he recognize and identify the car?
That's good. That's good.
He's really good at it. Okay. All right. Next question. In the 2000s, canned soup companies, Progresso and Campbell's, went at each other via ad campaigns over what ingredient? I'll say it again. In the 2000s, canned soup companies Progresso and Campbell's went at each other via ad campaigns over what ingredient?
Okay.
All right.
Answers up, please. Colin says noodles. Oh, Dana says chicken. Chris, you said?
I said chicken. I felt like it was like the chicken noodle soup thing, but it was like you have more chicken in the chicken noodle soup. I don't know.
The answer is MSG.
Oh, really?
So like, it's not about like I have more of it. It's more like you have more of it.
No.
Okay.
Which is really funny. I mean, MSG was such a weird worry back then.
It was. It really
and
was.
And now it's like everybody's like, oh, umami. Yes, umami. And it's like, that's MSG.
Yeah.
According to data collected by Variety VIP Plus in the end of 2021, Netflix is the number one streaming service based on global subscribers. What is number two?
Based on the of when?
2021. So it would still hold true. I mean, I think looking at these numbers, it's probably impossible to change that much.
Interesting.
Netflix is the number one streaming service. What is number two? All right, answers up, please. Chris, you put?
Amazon Prime Video.
Dana put Amazon Prime. Colin put HBO Max. It is Amazon Prime. Good job.
See, I wasn't sure if that would count or not. Yeah, I should have just trusted myself.
Because there are people already subscribed
To Prime. Yeah, I should have just, don't overthink it. Don't overthink
it. That's part of the whole strategy.
Yeah, that's why they got so many. Yeah.
People didn't originally want to subscribe to the Netflix service. They just wanted their DVDs, right? So it was sort of like an extra thing you got. Yeah.
Next question. What two countries were involved in the 1976 Judgment of Paris? The event name is called Judgment of Paris. It happened in 1976 between two countries. What two countries were involved in the 1976 Judgment of Paris?
Interesting.
It was a big moment.
In what arena? You can't tell us.
In an arena I know you are familiar with based on what you did for this episode.
Oh, okay.
All right, answers up.
Two countries.
All right.
All right, rivalry. Colin put France, Italy. Dana also put France, Italy. Chris put France, U.S. It is France, U.S. Chris got the point. Well, everybody gets a point for France.
Okay. I believe it was wine tasting, and it was when a California wine upset a French wine in France. Is that it?
Taste test between Napa, Sonoma, Northern California wines, which people didn't really know about that much, versus, the French wines. Mm. And they had a blind tasting contest, and there was a lot of uproar because sometimes the California wines got scored higher than France. And it was a big deal because they're kind of who are these Californian hicks, right?
These upstarts,
Yeah. Versus our long tradition, French tradition of wines. And so this was a big deal. Also made into a movie starring Alan Rickman called Bottle Shock. Inspired by true events. It's looking pretty even here. Let's do two more questions. I'll throw in two hard questions. Here we go. DC and Marvel are two of the biggest comics rivalry. Before DC became DC and Marvel became Marvel, what were their previous company names? Before DC was called DC, before Marvel was called Marvel, do you know what their previous company names were? I have all of them up, so if you get any one of them, you'll get a point.
This is in the punch bowl. Okay. I've had this, yeah.
It's hard, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, it's not Detective Comics, which is what DC stands for.
Okay.
Throw in a fun name if you don't know.
I'm going to be so mad at this one, Karen.
I feel like you would know for sure.
It's Once Upon a Time, it would have come right to the front of my brain here.
All right, answers up. Here we go. Colin put Action Comics and Tales of Suspense. Dana, you put Action Comics and...
Really Good Comics.
Really Good Comics. You know what? That's pretty close. And then, Chris, can you read out your answer?
Exciting Comics and American Comics, because I have no idea.
It's so generic. So DC is known by many things, including National Comics. National publications. Yeah, pretty close. And then Marvel before was called Atlas. And even before that was Timely Publications.
That was the one, man, that was way in the punch bowl. Timely.
This is some deep cuts.
Hey, sometimes trivia is hard.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. Last question, please have some room on your piece of paper. I will time you for this. We know that the two biggest boy band rivalries were probably between NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. I'll give you 30 seconds, and please name me as many Backstreet Boys members and NSYNC members. Oh, first names, okay. First name. You don't have to do full name. If you do full name, I'll be very impressed. But so as you guys are writing, boy band rivalry was at its highest with NSYNC versus Backstreet Boys. If you can, please name all 10 members of Backstreet Boys.
I'm going to predict that I am dead last on this list. Let's see. Let's see if I can
this is 10 points.
Exceed my own expectations.
There are also other international boy bands. Westlife was very big. Take That, also a British boy band. The boy band where Robbie Williams came from.
Yeah.
Of course, there was NKOTB. All right.
Okay.
Please.
I
answers. Mm. You know what? Why don't you guys read?
I feel like we had a really heated competition here until this one.
You know, sometimes trivia is hard.
That's right. Sometimes trivia is hard, man. That's right.
All right.
How about I'll go first since I feel pretty confident that I am not going to lead the pack here. Okay. I got Justin Timberlake.
Yeah.
I got Joey Fatone.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
I got also from NSYNC. Lance Bass.
Yes, also from NSYNC.
Is there a Mikey Pickles in any of these? No. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Then I'm going to stop there then. So I think I got myself three here is what we're looking at.
Before we get into the answers that I wrote down, in the hopes of getting some bonus points here, I did write down all five members of 4Town, which I think should count for something.
From Turning Red.
Exactly. That's Robert, Aaron T, Aaron Z, Tae Young, and Jesse. Now, as far as the actual question, I put Justin Timberlake, was Nick Lachey in any of these? Or no? Was he in something
else? He's in 98 Degrees.
Oh, son of a gun. All right, so Justin and Joey then.
Okay, Dana.
Justin Timberlake, Joey Fatone, Lance Bass, JC Chazé, and Chris Kilpatrick. Correct. Kirkpatrick. I was like Chris K something. Yeah. And then Backstreet Boys, there's Nick Carter. There's a Kevin something.
Kevin Richardson.
There's an Aaron Carter, but he wasn't in Backstreet Boys. I was in the NSYNC gang.
I'm in the Backstreet gang. Nick Carter, Kevin, Brian, AJ, and
AJ.
Howie.
I knew there were initials, but I was like, BJ? What's the guy's name? Yeah, AJ.
Woo!
It's good to be humbled every now and then in trivia.
Trivia's hard. Trivia's hard. Yeah.
Well, that's why we're on a trivia team.
Guess what, guys? Dana won.
Oh, yeah.
Yay. Oh, yeah. Good job.
Huh.
Yeah.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
All right. Well, we've had some good slogan and tagline references so far. So this is a good segue here for me. I'm going to give you guys some slogans here. All right. And I want you to tell me what product or service is being pitched with these slogans, all right? These are from various times over the last number of years. Don't let the big one get away. Today could be the day. And another one, somebody's got to win, might as well be you. any
at
guesses
At first I
here?
Thought it was like pest control. Like don't let the big one get away.
Like lottery.
Yes, right. These are perhaps no surprise. These are state lottery slogans. And you know, they don't really range all that much, I guess. It's just, hey, you know,
you
why not?
Win.
You could do it. Yeah, you might win.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of variations on dream big and today could be your day.
Oh,
and right. You gotta be in it to win it.
Don't think about the math, you know.
Absolutely.
What taxes?
At Christmas, in my family, for years and years, we always had a tradition. I'm sure a lot of families have this too, of the little lottery scratch-off tickets in the stockings.
Oh, yeah.
You know, my mom would always get, you know, a couple little scratch-off tickets. Like, almost invariably, it seems like my sister would win $2. It was like, it kind of just came like a running family joke. None of us would ever win. My sister would win the $2.
And, but that's still exciting.
Yeah. Oh, man. Especially if you're like a kid. Yeah.
I got a lottery ticket from your house at a party once, or you guys gave lottery. I didn't steal it. You gave it to me.
Chinese New Year.
I got $5, and then I just carried it in my purse for a year, and I never cashed it.
We had another tradition of my house. The second tradition was we would leave the ticket in the stocking for a whole year and forget about it. And then next Christmas, we're like, oh, yeah, I won $2 that I never claimed and is now even more profit to the state of California.
We had this tradition also, and I'd never tell you the story of the year that my brother got me a prank lottery ticket. You can go to like Spencer's Gifts or whatever and buy a fake scratch-off ticket
that says
$25,000. Yeah. So I get it in my stocking and I scratch it off and it says I've won $25,000. And I couldn't even believe it. I'm like, oh my God. And I look over to the side and I see my mom is sitting at the kitchen table with her head buried in her hands, kind of like laughing. You know what I mean? Because she knew. And then I started to realize that something was up, because like, this is the sort of prank where it seems like a really funny prank until you do it. And you realize that it's actually horrible to do that to somebody. They did this. They also have very bad, like actually a family friend of ours, they did this to their daughter. And she was like, I am out of here. Yeah. Yeah. So
you got to walk that back. Yeah.
Because it's like she lost $25,000. Like they stole $25,000 from her.
You're just that's sitting right, yeah. there in stunned silence the rest of Christmas. I thought it would be fun to look into the history and kind of some lore around the state lotteries. Just, I mean, kind of as an American institution. I mean, we have a really big one here in California. Almost every other state has one.
Do other countries have government lottery system?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're really, really, really common. Almost every country has some version of a national lottery or state lotteries. It's a great way to make money. It really is. And people like to gamble. They really do. Not surprise you that lottery itself, the concept is ancient practically. I mean, in some form or another, the idea of choosing, you know, something at chance with a big payoff. So I started thinking, all right, let me look how lotteries were introduced into America. And that did not end up being nearly as interesting as how they were reintroduced into America. Oh. Lotteries are really, really, really old. And I guess it shouldn't have surprised me to learn like they had them in the colonies. They had them in the early days of America. They were a great way to raise money for the state or for the municipal government, what have you. But in the late 1800s, sort of how we had anti-alcohol and temperance movements, there was really a wave of anti-lottery sentiment, all right? Mm-hmm. And up to this point, like in the U.S., it had sort of been kind of, I'm not going to say quasi-legal, but there were a lot of sort of open secret illegal lotteries being run.
Okay.
But there was a big wave of this is immoral, we got to shut these down. So, you know, in the U.S., they were kind of shut down or quiet or underground for a while. As sort of these moral panics died off, a lot of states like, we got to get back into the lottery business here. The first sort of resurgent state official lottery was New Hampshire in 1964. Rolling through the 70s, rolling through the 80s. It was kind of a domino effect where, you know, once a state would start running a lottery, people would drive across the state border to play the lottery. It's like, you know, hey, why not? You know, I'll go buy a ticket, you know, because there wasn't really residency restrictions for these lotteries. And, you know, if you're a state and you see your, you know, speaking of rivalries here, and you see your neighboring state starting to pile up, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, millions and billions of dollars of revenue, you're like, yeah, I want some of that too. Now, of course, the public relations part of this, they got savvy, right? You know, like the pitch for almost every state lottery is help the schools, help the seniors, help the public works. Mm-hmm. You know, it funds our healthcare. And that is largely true. I mean, it does help them. Most of the money does not go to them necessarily. But states have, you know, written into the laws, like, you know, what percentage has to go to the state or has to go to education.
Oh, that's good.
The raw number might surprise you, how much actually goes to education versus paying out back out to winners. But look, it is money in California going to education. It is money in other places. Yeah. So like I was saying, we really got into it, my family, in the 80s. The California authorized the lottery in a ballot initiative in 84, with 58% of the public approved. The first California scratchers ticket went on sale in 1985. I learned that scratchers is a registered trademark of the California Lottery Commission. Yeah. There are some fun lottery variants around the world. So as you guys know, my wife and her family are from Taiwan. Karen, you are, of course, from Taiwan.
Oh, our receipts.
The receipt lottery is so fantastic, which is a way of forcing, you know, businesses to make sure they issue you a receipt if you can then cash in a number on
the
that
books.
Receipt.
Yeah,
that's right,
books.
For a state-run lottery. There have been a lot of really kind of interesting security goofs and protocols over the years. So like I mentioned, the lotto, you know, where they draw the numbers with the little kind of little puffer ball things that shoots them up through the thing. Right. You know, it was a really big deal. I mean, they still televise it, but like, you know, in the 80s and 90s, I feel like it was almost like appointment TV. You're like, they're drawing the lotto numbers. Let's get, you know, tune in and watch it. Choosing random numbers is hard. I mean, this is a known problem of choosing reliably random numbers is hard, right? There's an anecdote I heard years ago about, like, if you go to Las Vegas and you're watching the roulette wheel and black 17 comes up three times in a row, should you bet on black 17? You know, and sort of the trick answer is like, no, of course not. The numbers are all independent. Just because black 17 came up three times, it doesn't mean it's more likely to come up. But a lot of savvy gamblers will tell you, like, oh, if you see a roulette wheel play the same number, it's probably busted or biased physically somehow.
Like, so
you go ahead and play. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So the lottery system, in order to avoid people tracking, I mean, because look, you got money on the line. I guarantee you there are people who track the numbers every week. I mean, they're required by law to track the numbers, but you know, so the balls themselves, to avoid any possible bias they don't even know about, they have, most states that run these machines, they have multiple sets of equipment, okay? They have multiple sets of the balls and the little shooter and the hopper, and they will run a pre-lottery or a pre-draw either the day or the evening before of the draw to choose which of the machines will be used to run the actual draw, so that even the lottery officials themselves don't know and they're trying to try and hide the bias. Right, right. I mean, it makes sense, but it's really interesting.
Why
I never thought
they just
about
do
that.
It digitally.
Well, so here's the thing, Karen. I mean, look,
instead of the balls,
there's no such thing as truly random.
We'll tell you there is no such thing as a truly random computerized number, right? It's all pseudo random. So yeah, doing physical numbers is actually the safest way to do it. So, all right, I'm going to close out here with a few questions for you guys. This will be some write down. Get a pen, get your paper. I mentioned our family's scratch off scratcher tradition. What year do you guys think the scratch off instant win lottery ticket was introduced? Because for the long time, you know, keep in mind the lotteries were raffle style, okay? It was, again, like you're buying a ticket, you're getting the number. But
balls are
picked. The idea that you're getting something, taking it
instant.
Home, maybe in your car. Instant win, that's right. Instant win, scratch-off lottery ticket.
So it was before 1984, right?
Yeah.
That's right. You know, it's no later than that. You know, it's no later than that. All right, closest two will win the point here. Answers up. Karen says 1981. Dana says 1976. Chris says 1982. Dana gets the point. 1974, earlier than I would have thought. Yeah, 1974, Massachusetts State Lottery. You know, it was just an instant hit. You know, in fact, it was called the instant game, no pun intended. It was an instant hit. They were very, very popular. It sounds like within a week, the state had sold $2.7 million worth of scratch-off tickets. Yeah,
it's fun, too. It's interactive.
Yeah.
The 70s and 80s was a golden age of scratching things.
Oh, it totally
scratch
was.
Scratch and sniff.
So there are scratchers. The real big money comes from the Lotto and the Powerball style drawings. You know, we don't, unlike a lot of countries, we don't have a national lottery per se, but we do have Powerball, which all of these sort of the lottery state by state commissions work together.
That's
because
what
they all sell. Yeah, Powerball is kind of just like a consortium of the state
all
lotteries.
The states,
yeah, mm-hmm. That's
together.
Why. So you can get such huge, massive payouts. And in fact, a Powerball payout holds the record not just for the largest payout in American lottery history, but the largest lottery payout ever anywhere in the world was a Powerball jackpot from 2016.
Oh.
All right, there's going to be another closest to the point here. Single largest jackpot, shared by three tickets, but I'm looking for the jackpot amount.
Okay.
There was a ticket sold in California, ticket in Florida, another one in Tennessee. All right, when you're ready, answer's up. Karen has written $300 million. Dana has written $6.2 billion with a B. And Chris has written $32 million.
Oh, what a range.
I might be Dr. Eviling this, actually. I might be way low.
I'm going to say that I believe Karen is actually closest, but you're all off by a bit. The largest jackpot was $1.586 billion.
Wow. Oh, my God. God.
Right. Even when you give the government its share.
Hold on. So it costs money to buy a ticket. That money goes to the government. Then if you win, pretty much half of that goes back to the government as taxes.
Quite a racket.
Am I crazy? Is that what it...
The lottery winnings are taxed. I mean, it depends on your state, but lottery winnings are taxed at a very high rate. That's true. Right. And a lot of them... So like this one is a good example. A lot of the winnings, some of those will offer, you can take a one-time cash payment or you can take an annuity, right? You know, over 20 years. Some of the really, really large payments, it's obligated. Like you cannot take a lump sum. Like you're required to take it over the, you know, X number of years. And, you know, the states will earn money. I mean, they'll earn interest on that money. They have to set it aside. They have to have it to pay. But yeah, in the long run, you know, the state is coming out just fine. Again, the theme of the state lotteries, it's a great way to make money.
What a beautiful, game.
When you get to pick the rules.
That's right. That's right. In the spirit of the 1 point per answer here, five potential points on the table here. Still anyone's game. There are currently only five states that do not run a state lottery.
Ooh.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Five states. Now, this is a little tricky, but I think it's more than just random guess. I think you might be able to reason some, maybe most, maybe all of these out. Which five states, 1 point each, do not run a state lottery? And maybe you can think about some reasons why. Why might a state not want to run a lottery? Maybe there are powerful interests against it. Maybe they don't have the pressure. I don't know. What are some reasons? What are some reasons that a state might turn down these billions of dollars in revenue? You know, California is not one. You know, New York is not one. Well, you know, Massachusetts is not one.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Answers up. Karen has written Alaska, Hawaii, Nevada, Utah. I will tell you, Karen, you've got four of the five.
Wow. And then question mark.
I put Alaska, Hawaii, and Utah. I also put Rhode Island and Delaware because they're really small. I don't know.
Small states.
I had Hawaii, Utah, Alaska, and then I put Rhode Island as well. And I put Vermont randomly. Yeah.
Wow. You guys did really good. You clued in here.
Some logic.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if your logic matches here. I mean, so, you know, let's start with Utah. There is a lot of religious opposition, you know, being a very heavily Mormon state. It's a big part of it. Nevada, huge opposition from the casino gaming institution. They do not want the state horning in on their racket. So,
That's interesting.
It is interesting. It's almost, it's like, where's the honor among thieves here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hawaii and Alaska. So it's interesting. In no small part, they just simply don't have the pressure from adjacent states, you know, seeing the revenue go up that they need to feel the need to cash in. And then the fifth one is Alabama. And again, largely for religious reasons, there's a lot of opposition in the state. It's a fairly conservative state. You know, again, we'll see how long these states can hold out until just a couple years ago. Mississippi was on this list as well. Again, a state with a lot of big gaming casino interests, but just, you know, but just was not able to sort of hold back the tide. Governor of Alaska, like Alaska is pushing for a state lottery, an official state lottery. They're sort of in a quasi state right now where it sounds like there's some sanctioned lotto type events, but it's not an official state lottery. Yeah, good job, guys. All right. So 4 points to Karen there. I think Karen is our winner here. Well done.
Woo! Yeah.
All right. Before this episode ends, I have my final Wordle listener challenge. As you guys have heard for the past two episodes, I've developed this kind of like Wordle game that we can play on the podcast. The premise of this puzzle is pretend there is a person who is playing Wordle and all you have as information is their five Wordle word attempts. Can you use this information and work backwards to figure out what the correct answer word is? Now this person, again, is a very casual Wordle player, meaning they don't bench or bank letters. They will never repeat wrong letters. If they get a letter right, they'll always use it in their next guess. If they get a letter in the right place, they will always keep that letter there for their next guess. So the last two times I shared and I read out the words, this time I'm going to make it a little bit harder, and I'm going to give you trivia questions, and the answer for these are going to be the five-letter words in order. So here we go. So word number one, cartoon lab rat Brain's partner. Cartoon lab rat Brain, the name Brain, Brain's partner. Second word, Franzia is famous for what kind of wine? The brand Franzia is famous for what type of wine? Third word, this comes in many varieties, including Bavarian and Devonshire. Bavarian and Devonshire, what? Word number four, the animals that barnacles are named after. Number four, the word is the animals that barnacles are named after. And word number five, pound of blank. A Shakespearean demand for payment. Pound of blank. A Shakespearean demand for payment. And if you know the answers to these five clues, and then you can backward solve to find out what the final Wordle answer is, you can head over to goodjobbrain.com and you'll see a Wordle section and you can put in your answers there. So good luck. All right. And that's our show. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned stuff about lottos, about cooking contests, about balloon fails, and about rivalries. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all podcast apps. And on our website, goodjobbrain.com. This podcast is part of Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other shows like Everything Everywhere Daily, Legends of the Old West, and the Pirate History Podcast. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye. Bye.
Calling all trivia nerds, Brittany here, and I host the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast with my best friend, Meredith. Is your next car ride looking like a snooze fest? We've got the cure. Three rounds of awesome trivia every week. Harry Potter, Disney, science, sports, you name it. No more silent car troubles. The Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast. Connect, laugh, and learn with your kids, big and small. New episodes every week, wherever you get your podcasts. Search for the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast.